from 1977. That was Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks and their song The Chain. Two different chains, really. One is the chain where you try and keep things going even despite terrible personal differences, which is what the song's about. And then, of course, there's the COVID-19 chain, trying to break that. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trump says he's had enough of negotiating with China. What did Trump say? And does it matter? Also, the FBI released the names of a top Saudi intelligence official in Washington who helped the 9/11 hijackers while they were preparing to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We all know about bin Laden. He was Saudi. But is this the Saudi government caught in an act of war against the United States? Also, a nanotech vaccine for COVID-19. According to Whitney Webb, when it comes, what will be in the concoction injected into us? Will you let them inject you with it? If it's made by Bill Gates, DARPA and the Department of Defense, will it be safe? And also, we review two books, Jeffrey Robinson's Merger, How Organized Crime is Taking Over the World, as well as Christians Being Censored, James Perloff's Truth is a Lonely Warrior on YouTube, his book. And we hear from him about the idea of a major crisis being a Kissinger-esque push for world government and whether that might actually be a good idea. Also, his work on the end times prophecies. Perloff thinks we may be seeing a war in heaven going on, unfolding down here before our eyes. But we start, obviously, Martin, with Trump and his decision that he's had enough of negotiating with China. I mean, this hasn't really been reported much over here, but certainly in Iran and China itself, it's the top of the news.
Well, I mean, obviously, relations between the Chinese and the US are pretty poor and have been getting worse. And that's not going to have, you know, very good implications for the world economy. And, of course, it runs the risk of global war. And that's where we are.
So why has he decided to he doesn't want to negotiate anymore now?
Well, basically, what's happening is that the Trump faction within the US are trying to ramp up anti-China sentiment, because they hope on the back of that that Trump can be re-elected in November. So he's doing the best he can to blame the Chinese for the COVID outbreak. So we saw the Murdoch newspapers last week in Australia and elsewhere putting around this so-called leaked report, which pretty much looks as if it's just been cobbled together from the internet, which basically says that the virus comes from the Wuhan laboratory. But of course, the intelligence services themselves have briefed off the record saying that they didn't have anything to do with this report. So Trump is definitely he's pushing on an open door, because there's people are looking for somebody to blame for this, and from his point of view, it's what he's got to do. He's got to lay the blame on China.
Do you mean he's pushing an open door over in the White House?
Well, I mean, the White House is trying, and Pompeo and others are definitely trying to start. They're using China as a whipping boy to try and get re-elected. Now, ultimately, of course, they have to do some kind of deals with the Chinese one way or another. So in many senses, they're making their lives more difficult.
Well, this is not going to be very easy for Trump, is it? He got elected on the whole thing of no new wars.
Well, he didn't. He did and he didn't. And in actual fact, he's pretty much done what the Pentagon wanted anyway. And don't forget, the underlying policy of the US is to try and nobble China now before it gets to a point where it can't be nobbled. And that's obviously what may well be behind this whole crisis. The Chinese may be sitting on information that the source of the COVID outbreak is, in fact, possibly from the Wuhan Games or somewhere else. Fort Detrick in Maryland was closed down in the summer last year because of some kind of infraction. And what the Chinese are saying, well, tell us what happened in your biowarfare laboratory. And don't forget, the US has got biowarfare labs all over the world. There's one particularly controversial one in Georgia, there's some in Kazakhstan. And they've used biological warfare in the past against Cuba, against North Korea.
Anyway, look, bringing it back to this week, Martin, speaking in an interview with Fox Business Network broadcast on Thursday, Trump said he might even decide to sever diplomatic relationship between America and China. He's repeatedly accused China of failing to contain COVID-19.
Well, I mean, you can see what game he's playing. He's trying to get he's called his opponent Beijing Biden and so on. So that's the game they're playing. Now, that's internal US politics, but of course it has geopolitical implications. Now, if you really want to go to war with China, then you will end up going to war with China. But don't be surprised if you get a bloody nose.
Trump says they should never have let this happen, accusing the Chinese. So I made a great trade deal, and now I say this doesn't feel the same to me. The ink was barely dry and the plague came over, and it doesn't feel the same to me.
Well, in other words, there are elements within the deep state in the US who want to try and basically crash the Chinese economy and frustrate them from becoming a dominant power in the developing world over the next 20, 30 years. And if they don't do it now, it'll be too late. And that, when the history comes to be written, may be the explanation of everything that we're going through.
Trump says, right now, I don't want to speak to him, talking about President Xi.
Well, the Chinese will say, don't speak to us then. But when we get to a situation where you need our help, you can whistle for it.
Well, talking of which, Russia and China have slammed the US plan to extend the UN arms embargo on Iran. I didn't realize that they're going to do that. That's what they've said.
Well, yes, but at the same time, the Russians and the Chinese are going to ignore them and carry on supplying weaponry to the Iranians. And, of course, a war could break out in the Gulf, which will bring in Russia and China versus America. And, of course, we've got a British frigate threatening Venezuela at the moment, and they seem to be implicated in this coup. That's what we're doing. And, of course, in Britain, we're all obsessing with the coronavirus crisis. We may be being dragged into war with Iran and China by our US and Israeli allies, and we'll just find ourselves in it without having even talked about it.
Also, a US Navy warship has been transiting between the Taiwan Strait and the China's People's Liberation Army starts live fire drills. I mean, this Taiwan Strait, how is that, you know, strategically important?
Well, I mean, if you were the Chinese, you would want to have a reasonable control of the access to your mainland, wouldn't you? I mean, that's pretty much what the Royal Navy's been for hundreds of years. And on what basis does the US trail its coat around the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait? It's basically provocative, and the Chinese are going to respond as provoked. And, if you're going to do stuff like that, it only takes one mistake and one live fire incident, and you're off.
Now, the East China Sea is right next to that. I mean, Taiwan and China have got a long history, haven't they? Basically, Taiwan is a kind of US-style country right just off the coast of China.
Well, what happened at the end of the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s is that Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists who'd lost on mainland China retreated to Taiwan, basically overwhelmed the local population who had been always living there, were basically taken over by a lot of mainlanders who were anti-communist nationalist Chinese, the Kuomintang. It was not a democratic country for many years. It's become more democratic in recent years, and the locals who've always lived there basically just want to be an independent country. But neither the Kuomintang faction nor the Chinese communists want to accept that, because they basically think that China and Taiwan are part of the same country. In practical terms, they're not, although in recent years there's been massive amounts of trade and transport links between the two sides. And what's quite interesting, of course, is that when the Taiwanese realized that there was a virus problem in Wuhan, they immediately stopped and checked everybody coming in from China. And quite a lot of people do cross that all the time. And they did it very effectively. And they've managed to control the virus in Taiwan, as they have done in China. It's only the British and the West that doesn't seem to be able to manage to do it.
Well, Iran and China are both, it seems, falling out with the US, but not just them. Obviously, the Russians too. And this hasn't really, I haven't seen any reporting of this, but the Russia is saying that although they're trying, the United States is not willing to extend the new START treaty. Now, this START treaty involves the nuclear weapons, doesn't it? I mean, this is something that the Russians are saying, well, we want to extend this new START treaty. America is saying no.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically what Trump's done is he's ripped up all the treaties that have been negotiated before he came to power. And you can do that, but then you've got to have an arms race. And if you're going to have an arms race, you've got to find the money for it. If you've got to find the money for it, then you've got to cut something else. So when we're talking about rebuilding the US economy, investment in infrastructure, that'll all have to go down the drain because we've got to build more nuclear weapons.
Well, yeah, talking of which,
anymore. There's more than enough to destroy us all already.
Well, talking of which, antiwar.com are reporting that the world spent $73 billion on nuclear weapons last year, the US spending half of it.
Well, that's right. They're going to go back to the old policy of just ramping up nuclear spending in the hopes that they can bankrupt the Russians and the Chinese. Now, I think that won't work because the Chinese have only got a tenth of the nuclear warheads that the US has got. But the fact is they've got more than enough to wipe out the US. So they're not going to try and chase after it. The Russians have upgraded their nuclear forces so that they're able to hit anywhere in the world within half an hour. So they're not going to spend much more money on it. They've already reached what they want to reach. But in the US itself, there's this fantasy that the more you spend on nuclear weapons, the more powerful you become, even though in actual fact you can never use them without destroying yourself. It's silly, it's pointless, but that's what they're doing because that's how they are.
So nuclear threat, that's what they're basically saying. It's February, this new START treaty finishes. I suppose we could have a new president by then.
Well, we could. And it may be that Biden would be less belligerent than Trump, but I wouldn't count on it. The deep state in the US is a pretty permanent feature of the landscape. And they do not intend to cooperate with Russia and China. And
I mean, what do you make of the way that Bernie Sanders has been sort of elbowed out of the running?
Well, of course, and he was absolutely cheated of the nomination in 2016. And it's quite clear that it wasn't the Russians that cheated him of it. It was the secret services in the United States. And Biden has been pushed in to the Democrat nomination to keep Sanders out. Trump must have a reasonable chance against Biden because Biden's senile. But nevertheless, Trump is now thrashing around because what looked like a fairly easy election campaign for him is turning into a nightmare. And his reaction in those circumstances is to lash out, which is what he's been doing. It's very dangerous. I mean, his assassination of Soleimani in January, that, you know, you expect random events to kind of come along, like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in 1914, but you don't expect the most powerful man in the world to be the terrorist. But there he was, outside international law, assassinating other people's top generals with no rules.
We haven't really been looking and thinking much about Syria, have we, which was always in the news in the run-up to the pandemic. But now Hezbollah are saying that Israel sees Syria as an existential threat. There are regular acts of war by the Israelis against Syria. And I wonder, because a lot of this stuff seems to have been forgotten in the background of the pandemic, who are Hezbollah and why are they saying that Israel sees Syria as an existential threat?
Well, Hezbollah are part of the Lebanese democratically elected government. They've got a military wing which humiliated the Israeli Defense Forces when they last invaded Lebanon, and they're enemy number one as far as the US and the Israelis are concerned. That's why they are being targeted. But they are preparing to fight. They're preparing to fight. Everybody's preparing to fight.
But, I mean, they're a terrorist organization, aren't they?
No, they're a political organization with a military wing. You could say that Trump is just the political wing of the Pentagon, couldn't you? I mean, you can't, they're being called terrorists by Pompeo. They don't regard themselves as terrorists. They regard the US as terrorists. And since the US and the Saudis have been the major promoters of jihadi Salafist terrorism, Sunni terrorism, for over 30 years, they're not wrong. Our allies inside Syria are Al-Qaeda Syria. That's who the British Army are cooperating with. At the same time, of course, the Daily Mail and the Tory press over here continuously demonises Muslims. Meanwhile, our special forces are training the most extreme Muslims. You couldn't make it up, but it's true.
OK, but, I mean, another thing that's been going on, which has gotten virtually no coverage, as far as I've seen, is the attempted assassination of Hamdok in Sudan. He's one of the leading political figures there. Then there is massive protests going on in Sudan at the moment. How does Sudan fit into all the rest of these conflicts in the Middle East?
Well, the Sudanese army, some of them are fighting in Yemen in alliance with Saudi Arabia. That's a historical legacy of the closeness of the Sudanese military with the Saudis. But of course, the more democratic forces in Sudan aren't necessarily happy with that. I mean, why would you want to send your boys to die in Yemen? I think what's actually happening is all over the world, we're getting the acceleration of what were already very tense and difficult circumstances. And the UN Security Council was talking about the possibility of having a global ceasefire while everybody deals with COVID. But the US has shot that down. It was quite a long shot anyway, but it was actually going great gangbusters, really. Quite a lot of military groups around the world, like the ELN in Colombia, were saying that they were interested in getting into this idea of a global ceasefire. But the US wouldn't sign up to it unless everybody condemned the WHO and China as part of the resolution. And, of course, other countries weren't prepared to do that, so the whole thing fell. And in any case, the policy of the US seems to be, during this pandemic crisis, to use the crisis to try and nobble their enemies in Venezuela, as we've seen, in Iran and in China. Therefore, they're hell-bent, basically, on confrontation. And that's what we're going to get.
Well, we'll be talking about the amazing situation with the revelation by the FBI of a senior intelligence official working for the Saudi government in Washington who was aiding the 9/11 hijackers in a minute. But Martin, this whole situation is the backdrop of a real bit of a falling out going on between the Saudis and the United States. I suppose in the background of that, of course, is all this rising of tension between the US and China and the US and Russia and the US and Iran. But it seems that the relationship with Saudi Arabia is suffering, particularly over oil prices, as a result of other ship plates which are shifting amongst the superpowers, really. But what do you think is the situation now with Saudi Arabia? Because it's been a very key ally of the US for a long time, but the US seems to be cutting it adrift.
Well, I think the pressure in the US is coming from the oil industry, the fracking industry. They see the Saudi attempt to get market share as threatening them. And basically, their attitude towards Saudi Arabia is that it's a client state and they should just do as they're told and, basically dial back on their policy of trying to get market share for their oil. The tensions have always been there. And they're coming to a head. So, for example, they've withdrawn the Patriot missiles, which were sent in supposedly to protect the Saudi oil industry from missile strikes from the Anasrullah movement in Yemen. If we didn't have the COVID crisis going on, we'd all be talking about the possibilities for World War III. But in actual fact, everybody's so, obsessed with the immediate threat that they've failed to notice that this, in actual fact, we're moving rapidly towards confrontation on a geopolitical level.
Yemen, apparently there are some peace talks going on there. The Yemeni forces yesterday retook strategic positions from the Saudi-led, so-called government. It's really a kind of Western-sponsored puppet government there. And back home in the U.S., protesters are demanding an end to the lockdown in front of the Minnesota governor's residence. There's a lot of this going on in the US now. They're basically saying, well, we understand the dangers of the virus, but the lockdown is not the solution. And at state capitals around the United States, and in this case in Minnesota, outside the governor's residents, people are just saying, well, look, I mean, we're going to gather outside, we're going to have our protest. You've said that the rules mean we can't protest. Up yours.
Yeah, whether they're a majority or not, it doesn't really matter. They're going to do what they're going to do, and Trump is encouraging them. So on the one hand, Trump, well, he speaks, you know, he obviously he's not a reliable person. He changes what he's saying from day to day. He thinks that by pushing for an end to the lockdown, he's going to help himself get re-elected. A lot of his financial backers are people who want to end the lockdown. They're people who own, you know, certain kinds of industries which are going to benefit or in the short run from ending the lockdown. I think lockdown ending or not ending, the crisis in the financial sector is going to hit anyway, one way or another. And of course, if you unlock down and then you have to lock down again, you'll find everybody completely confused. And of course, in the United States, if there is a massive collapse, and just look at the unemployment figures, don't forget the unemployed in the United States, whatever their politics, are armed with automatic weapons.
Well, I don't think that's quite the case.
The Chinese population is disarmed, apart from the People's Liberation Army. The US population is not. So if you do find out, you know, you could be looking at shootouts between these militias and the police, or these militias and the army, or other, you know, and if it starts, you know, the potential, what we're going to see now is the social system in China is going to be tested to the limit, and the social system in the United States is going to be tested to the limit. And I think that the United States is more likely to crack.
Okay, interesting. Also, Biden has been saying that anyone who believes Tara Reid should not vote for him. Who is Tara Reid?
Well, it's one of his somebody who used to work for him, who claimed that he was basically touching her inappropriately and propositioning her and so on. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it certainly sounds plausible. And he's basically got a track record of doing stuff like that. He's really rather unsuitable candidate. But that's American democracy for you.
Well, look, I get back to one and the other.
I
get back to this point we made about Bernie Sanders. How come the Democratic Party have chosen this guy who's got a really tainted record? He's very easy, really, for people to criticise, even within the Democratic Party. He's seen as one of the sort of elite oligarchy. There's this whole Hunter Biden scandal to do with him getting rid of the chief prosecutor in Ukraine in order to help an oil company that he was part of over in Ukraine. He just seems to be a walking disaster. I suppose it might be that he's more or roughly around the same level of walking disaster as Trump.
Well, I'd say that's pretty accurate. The problem is that the US political system is owned by the oligarchy, and nobody is allowed to get anywhere near a sniff of power unless they've already been absolutely compromised by that oligarchy. And in that sense, Biden is perfect from their point of view, because he's one of them. He's in their pocket. He's got lots of dirty washing in the cupboard, which can be brought out to keep him in line. And if he wins, he will be a reliable backer of Wall Street and the Pentagon. And in actual fact, you can run third party candidates in the US system, but because it's a first past the post system like the one we've got, they've got no chance. And all that will happen if a third party, like Tulsi Gabbard, for example, could run as a third party candidate, but all she'll do is take the votes from Biden and let Trump win. And that's why she's backed Biden, as has Sanders. But the system itself is the problem. I mean, there's lots of things wrong with the Chinese system as well. It's not, to say the least, that's not a democratic system. But it's also an effective system, whereas the US system is not a democratic system, and it's an ineffective system.
Well, Yahoo News broke the story earlier this week. The FBI named a name. That name is Mossad Ahmed al-Jarrah. He was working for the Saudi government at the Saudi embassy in Washington apparently something called the GID, which is the Saudi Secret Service. And he was helping the hijackers for the 9/11 attacks in 2001. This idea of the FBI mistakenly releasing his name. I mean, we know that these strategic leaks can happen, and I'd like to hear your opinion, Martin, on whether you think it's an accident this name has come out now or not, because there's a lot of tension going on with Saudi Arabia. But the way I understand these things work is, you know, you'll get the head of the FBI be told, right, we want to cause some trouble for the Saudis, so this name gets leaked, and then the head of the FBI will phone the journalist at Yahoo News and say, you want to look at these court papers, there might be something interesting in there. So they tip them off, and then of course it's going all around the world now. Musayed Ahmed Al-Jarrah was a Saudi diplomat, Saudi government official helping the 9/11 attackers. Up till now we've heard about bin Laden and the Saudi citizens, but it looks as if the Saudi government itself was actually involved in an act of war against the US.
Yeah, well, it may be, as you say, that the timing is to do with tensions between the Saudis and the US, but it's all to do with a lawsuit by victims of 9/11 families who've been trying to sue the Saudis, and they tried to get documents released, and the courts decided that it would threaten US national security to release the documents. This is why we're finding out about all of this, but by accident or not, this name has been allowed out. I have to say that although the mainstream theory is that there were 19 hijackers who hijacked these planes, lots of more informed people realize that the hijackers possibly didn't even get on the planes, and that the planes were flown by Global Hawk technology into the buildings and so on.
Hang on. I thought that there was CCTV of some of these hijackers getting on the planes in Boston.
No. That was before they got on the flight. That was when they were getting the link plane to because they got on two planes to fly. Anyway, as you'll know, Tony, there's massive research that's gone on in the subsequent years into what actually happened, and we still don't know.
Well,
story behind all of that is bunkum.
And what I'll try and do is I'll try and get, because I know someone who's actually interviewed two of the guys who said that they were on the actual list of hijackers who never actually died. At least that's right. That's what they said.
The Daily Telegraph and the BBC interviewed people the following week and said, we're on this list, but we're still alive. Here we are. We can't be the hijackers. We're still alive, and here we are in Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Well, it might be as simple as that. They might be their name might be Martin Summers, and you know there might be more than one Martin Summers around.
Well, and it may also be that they basically created some false. What you've got to remember about these kind of psychological warfare operations is two things going on. One is the actual operation to blow up the buildings to create the effects that you want to do, the technical side. The other is to create a trail of fake evidence pointing in a certain direction. And I think you'll find that the Saudis, deep state, the Mukhabarat, will be cooperating with the CIA and MI6, who are also cooperating with Mossad, to create the whole illusion of the whole thing. And I'm quite sure that the US General Staff and the Chinese General Staff and the Iranian General Staff have got a pretty good idea of what happened. The Iranians, for example, uncovered the fact that everybody on the plane that crashed at Shanksville, however it crashed, everybody on that plane worked directly or indirectly for the Pentagon. Impossible.
I know, but you see, in that situation, it might be that those people were just under orders to get on that plane. The plane would land safely, they would get off, and the idea was to create a whole list of people on a flight, but actually there were no civilians on that flight.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, that's so there's all sorts of possibilities.
I mean, that's the implication. And of course, going back to 1964 and Operation Northwoods, what they planned to do there was have planes hijacked and crashed, but there wouldn't actually be any casualties. There'd just be a pretend casualty list. Now, if I was going to do something like that, I'd make sure there was a real casualty list. And of course, there was a real casualty list in New York, but that was just random people who happened to be in the building. The world has never been the same since those attacks. As Blair said at the time, this changes everything. He was right, but in the wrong way. You can be sure that if people like us, with our limited resources, are aware of the massive holes in the official story, that other powers who've got far more resources than we have know an awful lot more than we do.
That, an Operation Northwoods from 64 you're talking about was penned by a guy called Leland Lemnitzer.
Yep.
Who was a Bilderberger as well as a top official at the Pentagon. And apparently, President Kennedy wasn't interested. He said, no, this is a, you know, an operation too far. But the military seemed to be often pushing these things, and you need a very strong president, unlike Trump maybe, to stop them doing it.
Yeah. And I think, you see, let's just have a thought experiment. If the viral attack in China was actually a military attack on China, there's no guarantee that Trump would be involved in knowing about it. So he then responds to stuff that he doesn't really know what's going on. I mean, Trump on the day of 9/11 itself said those buildings must have been bombed because they don't collapse like that. Don't forget, Trump is a real estate guy. He builds skyscrapers. And he's quite aware that the skyscrapers don't collapse like that unless they've been bombed. He said that on the day. Giuliani, who's Trump's lawyer, he seems to be somebody who knew what was happening. Because he was the mayor of New York on that day. And he seemed to have some kind of knowledge about what was going on, whereas Trump doesn't. And that could explain why Trump is not be well liked inside the deep state, because he isn't basically in the inner circle. But nevertheless, what we're dealing with here is truly evil and on a very big scale.
So also, Martin, I thought it'd be worthwhile looking at some of the implications. I almost feel like doing a kind of weekly Bill Gates roundup, because there's so many articles coming out, fascinating insight, and some of it is being picked up from many years ago to do with Bill Gates and his vaccine program, which quite clearly seems to be one of the things that's been driving, along with Bill Gates' amazing amounts of money, the policies they're reacting to the COVID-19. And just like to refer you to an article which is on Mint Press News, The Faux Generosity of the Super Wealthy, Why Bill Gates is a Menace to Society. And maybe at the end we'll play Chinny B's wonderful Menace to Society song from the 1990s at the end of the show. But if Gates represents a net negative force in world politics, why does he receive such good press? For starters, he makes sizable donations to a host of mainstream corporate media outlets. That's what the journalist Alan McLeod is saying on Mint Press News. Now, there's a lot of money that goes from both Microsoft and from the Gates Foundation to media. So this obviously is going to sort of sweeten the pill, if we could call it that, of the vaccine pill.
Well, I mean, Bill Gates has got a reputation in alternative circles as being the fount of all evil. And I'm pretty much opposed to his empire building myself, but he isn't in many ways. He is the face of other people that we don't know who they are, who are pulling strings behind him. I think he's what he does, of course, and this is what all billionaires do, is that they create these foundations for so-called philanthropy. And that means all the money that goes into the foundations is tax free because it's for charity. And that means they can then use these foundations to push various political projects which are to the benefit of their non-charitable activities. So basically, somebody who's a computer programmer has appointed himself as the world's expert on health matters, and he's the biggest funder. Now that the US state has withdrawn, he is the biggest funder of the World Health Organization. That cannot possibly be right.
The Gates Foundation, in this article, quotes, the Gates Foundation has spent 20 years relentlessly championing business solutions to inequality and poverty. Through this corporate approach, Mr. Gates personally and the Gates Foundation more generally have enhanced the power and clout of corporations at every level of decision making, regional, national and international. The Gates Foundation has helped make philanthropy a handmaiden to corporate power rather than helped to empower the non-profit sector, which can act as a check on corporate profiteering and abuses of power. So I'll put a link up to the article on our show page. But what do you think of that? The Gates Foundation actually, helping to squash the non-profit sector and doing a lot to help big corporations.
Well, what happens is they, because they're the money bags, the not-for-profit sector is basically being taken over by them. And they then present themselves as being, trying to benefit humanity and all the rest of it. And in actual fact, they've got their own agenda behind the scenes. Richard Branson, for example, helped to fund the concert for Venezuela, which was held just inside Venezuelan territory, which was a deliberate provocation to try and start a war between Venezuela and Colombia. And Branson, as a philanthropist, decided he was going to stick his finger into that. Now, of course, what may happen if we get a crash is that, in fact, you end up with a situation where Branson and Gates go bust. So in actual fact, their money's paper money anyway. But they're all treated as if they are the world's leaders.
I might suggest that everyone else goes bust and they're the only two left standing. But look,
well, that
Martin,
may be the case.
Martin, one example, he says, of the foundation enhancing corporate power of Gates is the close relationship with the pharmaceutical and chemical giant Monsanto, who the Gates Foundation helped to gain a strong foothold in Africa and oversaw a flawed clinical trial of the HPV vaccine in India in 2009, where 23,000 impoverished girls aged 9 to 15 were exposed to lethal drugs without even their parents' consent, leading to 7 deaths. He is also preoccupied with controlling Africa's population through family planning during a population boom. Gates is also one of the most important individuals, and maybe we can finish looking at this article on this note, and it's some education, which I know you were working in, and your father, leading the assault on the American Public Education Network in the form of charter schools, effectively privatized the public school system in the US, where the public continue to foot the bill for the school but have no influence on how it's run.
Well, it's pretty much like the academy system here. I mean, when I was a kid, all schools were run by the local authorities and were answerable to the local authorities who were elected by the people. That's no longer the case in this country, and it's no longer the case in the US. Taxpayers' money is basically channeled to private organisations who make, if they don't make a direct profit from it, what happens in academy chains here? I noticed that the Oasis Academy chain here, which I used to work for, are keen to go back to work on June the 1st, or at least their bosses are. But I'm not quite sure that the teachers are. And there's no accountability. The public money to deal with the crisis has been farmed out to Boots, for example, are going to run the testing regime, not the NHS. Boots, a profit-making company.
Also, looking at Gates, before we finish with him, I mean, there is Whitney Webb has penned this quite interesting article looking at the idea of a nanotech vaccine, and that there's quite a lot of these companies that produce vaccines, a lot of work that they've been doing over the years that they haven't shared with the rest of us. And it may be that one of the reasons they're quite confident in having a vaccine is because they've got quite a lot of technology out there which is hidden, but which is actually to do with vaccines that operate in a different way to, say, something as simple as maybe the hepatitis vaccine or things like the smallpox vaccine, which was one of the original ones.
Well, I sent you an article this week from the Nigerian press where the opposition in Nigeria have accused the government in Nigeria, which is a pro-Western government. The guy used to be a military general who runs it, and he used to run Nigeria as a military dictatorship. And the Gates Foundation have been lobbying. They've given a massive bribe to the existing government to make COVID-19 vaccines compulsory in Nigeria. And as the opposition in Nigeria said, there isn't even a vaccine yet, so we certainly don't need to pass legislation to make it compulsory to be vaccinated. Now, this is all very suspicious. At some point, they may just come forward and say, oh, here it is, the vaccine, and it's got to be compulsory. And they're already lobbying for it to be compulsory in Nigeria. And they've given a massive bribe. I can't remember. It was several million dollars to the existing government to pass this legislation. I don't know whether it's passed or not, but I think that's a pretty strong indication that they're playing fast and loose. Why would you want to make a government make a vaccine and this is what the opposition is saying, why would you want to make vaccination compulsory when there isn't even a vaccine? What are you talking about?
A new system to control the likes of worlds we've never seen. So, well, I mean, is it feasible that there could be some sort of new type of vaccine using nanotechnology?
Well, the nanotechnology aspect of it is this, that if you've got a vaccine, you vaccinate people with it, but you also stick in a little chip, effectively, which means that anybody, you can then say who has and who hasn't been vaccinated. And on that basis, you can then say everybody who's got the chip can go to parties, can go to football matches and all the rest of it. And then you just check everybody on the way in, blip, 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 they're all chipped. And of course, the more extreme conspiracy theorists on the internet, and of course, also to do with the Book of Revelation, all the rest of it, you're very well aware of this. They think that that's what this is all about. I'm not of that ilk. I don't tend to believe in prophecies, and I think we're going to come on to something about this in a minute. But I certainly don't trust these people as far as I can spit.
DARPA, Whitney, is also talking about being involved in this. That, I think, is something like a defense evaluation research project in the United States. DARPA is apparently very much involved in this whole world of high-tech vaccines, and so obviously we'll be looking into this. But it is actually a military project, I believe.
That's right. I mean, the various biological warfare facilities in the West, including Port and Down, of course, are supposedly there in case an enemy, whoever that might be, Al-Qaeda that we've set up, for example, are developing biological weaponry. And therefore, they need to experiment with it so that they can block. The US hasn't ratified the Convention Against Biological Weapons. They signed it, but they haven't ratified it. And they've got all of these biological warfare labs around the world.
Well, what's the difference?
Well, what the difference is, you basically say you're not going to develop biological weapons, but by not ratifying it, it means that you can, and they are, and they're not developing them necessarily inside the US. So they're in foreign countries, basically client states like Georgia. And there's lots of questions about what's been going on there, because they seem to have been experimenting on the local population with biological weaponry. And, the fact is that when they say that there's a threat of biological weaponry from Al-Qaeda, which they run anyway, what they mean is we're developing biological weaponry. And that is possibly what's going on here. This is not just a random event. It may be that we're already in World War III and COVID-19 is part of it.
Whitney Webb points to an article at Wired.com from 2011. DARPA say do away with antibiotics, then destroy all pathogens. So what she's trying to do here, I suppose, is to point out that actually there may be an enormous amount of military big pharma research that we are not privy to. This article says Americans may be on the verge of a post-antibiotic era. And that's what the Pentagon's far out research agency DARPA is after. As long as they've got a replacement at the ready, in the military's latest round of small business solicitations, DARPA is making a long shot request for all out replacements to antibiotics. The decades of old standard for killing or injuring bacteria. The emerging field of nanomedicine would be used to fight bacteria. So there's a lot of nanotechnology involved in medicine, which we've not really been talked about. And it certainly doesn't seem to have been closely looked at by the regulators here in Britain, sort of NICE and people like this.
Well, obviously, inevitably, there's an awful lot about this kind of world that we don't know. What goes on in Port and Down? What goes on in there? We don't know. We do know that the Russians dismantled their chemical warfare facility in Uzbekistan, because Craig Murray, who was the British ambassador there at the time, was there when the whole place was dismantled. In theory, nobody is supposed to be developing chemical or biological weapons. In practice, the West has been developing and deploying biological and chemical weaponry, at the same time as accusing everybody else of doing it. Now, I don't trust any of these people at all. I don't really know what's going on, nor do you, but I'm pretty certain that it's not what I would want to be going on. And people need to wake up to how militant and nasty the deep state is embedded within our own societies.
Well, okay, so we've had a good look at the geopolitical situation, China, Russia, the Middle East, and we've also been looking at the whole business of Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation, Big Pharma, and I thought it'd be a good time now to have a look at this new book that's just out, and this is a clip from the BBC World Service, which is reviewing the book. The programme is called The Real Story. The presenter is Ritula Shah. And here she is talking to Jeffrey Robinson, who's the author of The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World.
Jeffrey Robinson is our third panellist. He's the author of the books The Laundryman and its sequel, The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World. Jeffrey, what's the one thing that surprises you that people perhaps don't know or think about when it comes to organised crime?
Well, the first thing is that they think of criminals. That's wrong. Crime is a business, and organised criminals are businessmen. And I think that if you suddenly realise that it's not about crime, it's about business, and the product doesn't matter, but opportunism does, then that wraps up what Misha said and what Vonder says. These are huge business enterprises who have done what the Harvard School of Business says all businesses must do in a globalized society, which is form joint ventures and strategic alliances. And that's why you have Italian businessmen called the Camorra linked up with Russian businessmen or Nigerian criminal enterprises, or the Colombian cartels. They're all in it for money, which is why when you get to policing, if you go after criminals, you're going to lose. If you go after the businessmen and the money, you stand a chance.
Well, that's a fairly tough thing to say there. That's Jeffrey Robinson, author of The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World. Martin, he says basically most of the law enforcement agencies in the world are looking in the wrong places for the criminals.
Well, I mean, let's think of it this way. One of the major criminal enterprises is illegal drugs. And the illegality of the drugs industry means that it's incredibly profitable. If drugs were provided legally, the profit margins would be pretty minimal, like the profit margins on running a pub in this country. But of course, if it's illegal, the profit margins are enormous. And therefore, you can generate huge slush funds, which can be used in various ways. And the alliance between criminal cartels and the intelligence services, particularly, but not exclusively, the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States, is well documented going back to the 1940s. Alfred McCoy's book on the politics of heroin came out in the 1970s. And of course, during the Vietnam War, Air America, which was run by the CIA, was taking drugs from heroin from Vietnam into the United States to fund paramilitary forces inside Vietnam. It's been going on for a very long time. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime had a report coming out in 2009 after the 2008 crash, and the main thrust of the report was that the drug cartels had just washed all their money through the banking system because the banks needed the money and the cartels needed to wash it. That's how tightly webbed together these things are.
Well, how does Bill Gates fit into that then?
Well, Bill Gates, as a big business person, is operating within the same environment as all the rest of them. When he had this pandemic exercise, 201 or whatever it was.
Talking about Event 201.
Event 201, the participants in that were the CIA. So, and as we were mentioning earlier, all of these biological labs that are supposed to be looking into biological threats are funded via the Pentagon, which is a war machine. Are they funding that?
Well, Bill Gates has got quite a lot of strings to his bow, and this is what comes, I suppose, when you're the richest man in the world. He's just re-overtaken the Amazon boss, Jeff Bezos, as the richest man
Bezos
in the world.
Well, Bezos is like a trillionaire this morning, apparently, the first one.
But anyway, I was just reading something saying Bill Gates has just overtaken him in wealth again, because the two of them are kind of vying.
They've got their little competition going, haven't they?
They have. But anyway, Bill Gates is backing a plan to have a video camera watch every inch of the Earth from space. Earth Now, a new satellite project with high-profile benefactors, aims to cover the entire planet in detailed real-time video surveillance, including war zones.
Well, I mean, people are kind of accepting a far higher level of surveillance than they would in the past, because it's because they're basically there's various threats, you know, the pandemic, terrorism, whatever. But of course, and they say, well, if as long as I'm not doing anything wrong, I should be all right. But I ask those people to consider maybe the people that are doing the surveying are themselves the criminals and terrorists that you're frightened of. And then it becomes really sinister, doesn't it? The terrorists are the people with the surveillance equipment. And of course, the linkages between the US military and Islamist terrorism are huge. The Badr Brigade in Iraq this week is saying that US planes and helicopters are being used to ferry ISIS militants from Syria into Iraq. That's what they're saying. But you won't hear that in the mainstream news.
Also, I mean, we talked briefly, Martin, didn't we? We were doing a whole program, really, about the October 1944 nuclear test, evidence now with documentation and actually bits of uranium discovered in Germany. So that's 9 months before the American nuclear test, the Trinity test, the Manhattan Project test of nuclear weapons. But you mentioned this guy, Klaus Fuchs. Do you want to just say a little bit about him? Because it turns out he's got a bit of a Bristol connection.
Well, Klaus Fuchs was the son of a Protestant pastor in Germany, so he was a German citizen. And as a teenager, he got involved in anti-Nazi activity and drifted towards the Communist Party of Germany. And eventually he fled Germany because he was a communist and came to Britain. But he was also a physicist, and he got involved in the, you know, developing the nuclear weaponry. And he eventually, while he was doing that, he was passing information to the Soviets. He was eventually caught by British intelligence and put on trial and convicted of espionage against his adopted country, Britain. And he was sent to prison, and he died a couple of years ago in prison here in Britain, unrepentant, because as an anti-Nazi German, he was quite clear that he didn't think he'd done anything wrong from a moral point of view in providing the Soviets with what they needed to build an H-bomb. And what we now know, looking at the documentation that's come out, is that they were definitely discussing the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union at the end of World War II when they didn't have nuclear weapons. So Fuchs actually played a very important role in the Soviet nuclear program, which probably, through deterrence, kept the peace. Can you imagine what would have happened if the Soviets hadn't had nuclear weapons?
Well, we had something in Bristol called the Bristol Physics Lab. Not sure if it still exists. I spoke earlier this week to a former member of the Bristol Physics Lab and a physicist, retired, now living in Wales, Dave Lawton. And he started by explaining to me that there was a very peculiar bloke that turned up, was working at Bristol Physics Lab, that was working as a spy from the CIA in Bristol here.
He's a strange guy. He used to line all the nuts and bolts up, in the nuts and bolts drawer, and I used to shake them up and they go back and do it, you know. But then it came to a head when he moved from the particle physics department where I was working, and he moved to X-ray crystallography. Anyway, Martin Price, one of the technicians, we were having a discussion. He said, I'm so paranoid of this guy. He keeps asking me all personal questions. Well, a little while later, Martin did a very naughty, you could say it was a very naughty thing. He broke open into the guy's locker. He goes so paranoid, because we all had lockers to keep your personal belongings. And inside, he found a filing card index system with names of all members of staff on there, even photographs of them, all about them, their political interests and everything like this. Anyway, we confronted him, and the Technicians Union also confronted him. And he said, oh, he also had skeleton keys to get into the labs, the other labs, which were locked at night. He said he'd collected this information for his wife because he was thinking having a party for members of staff so she could talk to them on their interests.
Okay, so how were you actually able to prove that he was working for the American government?
Well, the Americans working at Bristol Physics Lab, because Bristol Physics Lab was rather left-wing. And you must remember that in the 1930s, there was a physicist called Klaus Fuchs, who was an atom spy. He got 10 years in this country, and he worked at Bristol Physics Lab. So obviously the Americans are so paranoid of Bristol Physics Lab, that's the Royal Fort, they obviously sent in CIA agents disguised as technicians. Anyway, the university was so freaked out, they made him resign, and where he went, I don't know. But not long after that, they planted another one in there.
Now, you say you were a bit left-wing. Were you leaking secrets to the Soviet Union?
No, no, no. We had Soviet physicists come and visit, because the head of the physics lab, Professor Powell, he was, they were all into peace. They were not into war. They were very anti-war in Bristol Physics Lab.
So that's Dave Lawton there speaking to me earlier this week. And Martin, it's quite obvious there was a bit of a left-wing caucus of anti-war physicists here in Bristol in the Cold War.
Yeah, well, Fuchs, as I say, was a German anti-Nazi activist. And he basically, the British intelligence took quite a while to work out what he was doing, but they did catch him in the end. And he basically said, well, I've done nothing that I'm ashamed of. If I hadn't passed this material to the Soviets, they wouldn't have been able to develop a nuclear program. And you would quite probably have nuked them. But you can't, because they've got the weapons themselves and you can't do it. So, if you know, the arguments against nuclear disarmament are that you've got to have deterrence. And that's why we're supposed to have our nuclear weapons for deterrence, although NATO doctrine is to use them first. But I don't think that if the Soviets had if the Soviets and the Chinese didn't have nuclear weapons, they'd probably been completely wiped out by now. So it's probably just as well they have.
Okay, well, we're going to listen now to some interviews to do with the censorship at YouTube. Amazingly had one of my YouTubes restored for the first time this week. I don't know. Of course, one of the problems is, I mean, I've been monetizing for quite a while, and then when I did my, I suppose you'd call it a film, it was really just a radio interview with some pictures on it, called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit, which got 1.75 million hits, and I was getting a bit of money in. Suddenly YouTube then decided to demonetize me. Well, I'm not the only one. There's many people, when they start to be very successful and their videos go viral, after putting all that work in to build up the channel, YouTube will then switch off the bank account, basically saying, oh, well, trying to pass the buck to the advertiser, saying, oh, the advertisers don't want to advertise with you anymore. Well, of course, this is extremely dodgy, extremely political. So we're going to have a listen now to someone called Sean from the SGT report. Now, he's got a few more subscribers than me. He's up over 500,000 subscribers. And here he is talking about being demonetized after putting up an interview the other week with a guy called James Perloff, and we'll be hearing a bit more from Perloff. And I rather like doing this. When you see something's being censored, you know, I like to have a good old look at it. What is it they don't want us to know?
April 21st, 2020. That was the date I released my video with James Perloff titled COVID-19 and Their Beast System on the Record. Well, YouTube removed that video just a few days ago, and I emailed James Perloff about it. Big Brother strikes again. They're all in on it. You want to talk about conspiracies? This is the ultimate conspiracy. They don't want us talking about alternative therapeutics to a Gates vaccine. They're terminating content on YouTube containing discussions about this pandemic. And when I say they're all in on it, friends, the ultimate conspiracy, the billionaire behind TikTok has just committed $10 million to a Bill Gates-backed accelerator for COVID-19 therapeutic treatments. That's right, the Chinese billionaire founder of the social media app TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance, has pledged $10 million to the project founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to find and fast-track a vaccine. I would be willing to bet that if Zhang Yiming, the 36-year-old Chinese billionaire and founder of TikTok, if Zhang had a YouTube channel, it would probably not be demonetized as mine was today. I want to show you guys this. Your channel is no longer eligible to monetize. Upon a recent review, we found that a significant portion of your channel is not in line with YouTube's monetization policies. Please review our feedback below and make changes. And what is their feedback? Harmful content, content that focuses on controversial issues that is harmful to viewers. Now, friends, they're telling me that I can make changes to my channel, which means deleting videos and interviews, which I refuse to do. But if I do that, I can reapply after June 12, 2020. And, friends, I refuse to delete my free speech and my conversations with others about fact-based quantifiables just simply because YouTube doesn't like it and they refuse to give me advertising until I appease them. I will not appease them. And I'm not begging anyone for help. My channel has always been a public service and in the interest of truth and real journalism. But I don't have malevolent globalist benefactors like Jeff Bezos, who controls the Washington Post, and George Soros, who controls Media Matters and so much more. So if you have ever found value in this channel and what it stands for, I would ask you to consider visiting my Patreon page and becoming a patron in the continued fight for real news and real journalism 24/7.
Okay, that's Sean from, that's all he calls himself, Sean from the SGT report. But he's done much better than me with subscribers, Martin, and up until the other day, he was making a living at it. Now, he's all been switched off.
Well, YouTube, of course, is a private organisation run for profit. And just like the Daily Telegraph or any other private organisation, they can decide who they want to push and who they don't want to push. But, of course, the problem is with these YouTube, Google, Facebook, is they're effectively monopolies. And if you can't get access to via them, then you can't get access to people who might want to see your stuff. Ultimately, I would argue that these things should be treated as a public service and that freedom of speech should be guaranteed by law. And that doesn't mean stuff that, people should be allowed to say anything they like within the law. And there shouldn't be any kind of censorship of what they say. But as you know, the media isn't a public service. It's a for-profit setup. And it's also
well, the BBC. The BBC, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but the BBC has a more liberal policy on what things. You know, they have to be in balance. They're regulated by Ofcom and all the rest of it. I think ultimately that's the way it's got to be. But of course, the BBC itself, because of the licence fee, they can be bullied by the government of the day by simply saying, well, we're going to reduce your licence fee.
Yeah, well, also, they can be funded by the Gates Foundation too, can't they?
Well, indeed, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's also, as you know, there are joint projects between the BBC and other organisations.
All I can say is back in my day at the BBC, there was no Gates Foundation funding us then. And then we had John Burt, who was the Secretary General when I was working there, who brought in what they call producer choice, which actually gave producers less choice, which I think is fairly Orwellian. But anyway, the civil liberties aspect of this is, I mean, you know, the idea of a free press, we're kind of caught up in that because we're trying to get back onto FM. We're lobbying the management team at BCFM to go back on FM, and hopefully we'll be doing that sometime soon. But the civil liberties aspect was touched on by James Perloff, the interview with Sean, which was cut off then. So let's have a listen now to James Perloff. What the interview, the actual video which was taken down is called COVID-1984. And here is James Perloff, a US blogger. He's actually very good, quite interesting. I mean, you might say he's a bit anti-Semitic in that he does confuse sometimes Zionists with Jews, which is extremely problematic, but the actual, what he's saying here makes a lot of sense. This is about civil liberties.
The coronavirus is very handy because you can't see it. So you just say, oh, well, it could be on that object. So you can't buy it. So the case I was giving in Howard County, Indiana, was books. You can't buy books there because, so that's a modern form of book burning. But another one too is Google is now tracking people's movements with using their cell phones for the government. And of course, this is all in the name of, tracking the spread of coronavirus and preventing, illegal social gatherings. But overseas, it's even worse. You know, in Singapore, if you stand too close and you can go to jail for up to 6 months and be fined up to $7,000. In Tunisia, this is on YouTube, they've got these robocops, patrolling the streets. Now they're not autonomous. They're controlled by cops in offices, but they're, these, robocops are demanding that people stop and present their travel permits. In Greece, Bishop Seraphim Stergulius was arrested for opening his church for worship. And the Danish parliament in Denmark, passed a law authorizing the government to quarantine and vaccinated citizens without their consent. So we're seeing the formation of a worldwide police state. This is what we've been talking about for years coming true.
Perloff also talks about Bill Gates and his wonderful vaccines as well.
Gates' obsession with vaccines seems fueled by a messianic conviction that he is ordained to save the world with technology and a godlike willingness to experiment with the lives of lesser humans. And it gives many examples of the damage Bill Gates' vaccines have done. Let me just give you two. I'm quoting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Quote, promising to eradicate polio with 1.2 billion, Gates took control of India's National Advisory Board and mandated 50 polio vaccines, up from 5, to every child before age 5. Indian doctors blamed the Gates campaign for a devastating vaccine-strained polio epidemic that paralyzed 496,000 children. China, that's 500,000 children paralyzed. In 2017, the Indian government dialed back Gates' vaccine regimen and evicted Gates and his cronies from the NAB. Polio paralysis rates then dropped precipitously. And one other example that Robert F. Kennedy gives, again quoting, in 2010, Gates committed $10 billion to the WHO, World Health Organization, promising to reduce population in part through new vaccines. 2014, Kenya's Catholic Doctors Association accused the WHO of chemically sterilizing millions of unwilling Kenyan women with a phony tetanus vaccine campaign. Independent labs found the sterility formula in every vaccine tested. After denying the charges, WHO finally admitted it had been developing the sterility vaccines for over a decade. And Kennedy writes, Gates appeared gleeful that the COVID-19 crisis will now give him the opportunity to force his third world vaccine programs onto American children. End quote. And, you know, Sean, one way I know that Bill Gates is not sincere about improving people's health, when you ever see him talk, and I've not seen all his talk, but he never talks about getting exercise or vitamin C or vitamin D or improving your immune system, take it. He only talks about the vaccines. And I think that's here we want to close again with quotes directly from Bill Gates. He says, quote, it is fair to say things will not go back truly to normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out basically to the entire world, end quote. And I want to talk about how ridiculous this is, this idea of a coronavirus vaccine. I'm going to quote Dr. Stefano Montaneri, is an Italian nanopathologist, and this is what he says, quote, you cannot vaccinate against the common cold, which coronavirus causes the common cold, because the common cold does not give immunity. In the course of a life, a person can have cold 200 times, and in no time will that cold give immunity against the next version, end quote. So what he's saying here, Sean, is that every year the flu virus and the cold virus, they mutate. That's why we keep getting flus and why we keep getting the cold. You cannot vaccinate against the coronavirus. It's simply going to mutate into something new. So even if you got Bill Gates' vaccine, guess what? Next year there'll be a new mutation in the coronavirus, and it won't work anymore. Plus the fact, and Dr. B confirmed this to me, by the way, hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc already gives a very good effective rate of cure, reduction in symptoms to coronavirus victims.
So there is James Perloff. None of us are doctors and experts, but he's, I think, looking at the civil liberties aspects, the robocops, the vicars being arrested, and this sort of thing. But also, Martin, pointing out quite a lot of hypocrisies and contradictions in the whole idea of the vaccine.
Well, I'm skeptical whether you can have a vaccine against something like this. as he points out, we haven't got a vaccine against the common cold, and we haven't developed a vaccine for HIV. Although, of course, HIV, they've developed drugs which can basically prolong your life, even though they don't get rid of the HIV infection. I think, coming back to the wider question of freedom of speech, people should be allowed to say whatever they like, but inevitably there's going to be some people say, well, you know, that doesn't mean you're right, because you're allowed to say what you want. People should be allowed to say what they want, but you've got to accept that basically you might be wrong. And that goes for him, goes for us, goes for everybody.
It does seem, though, that YouTube has taken a particularly tough line, and it is where many, many people get their information from. Certainly yeah. we do, you know, when suddenly something disappears. And, you know, I've had quite a few of my videos taken down. You know, one of our earliest discussions, which was looking at the virus, Martin, you know, looking at ID 2020 and looking at the event 201 when I was still out in New Zealand. That was just, you know, removed without any, you know, basically without explaining why. You know, so of course, if they what YouTube say to you is you can now appeal this decision, but they don't give you any information about what they based the decision to take your video down on. Anyway, let's have another listen, because I like listen. I've never really come across James Perloff before, and I was annoyed to hear that he's been taken off YouTube. I mean, I would have thought if he's got nothing useful or worthwhile to say, or it's what he's saying is dangerous in some way, that they would just ignore it. Anyway, this is talking about his book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. And here he does a good job on stringing together why it is that just looking at one issue, I mean, we've looked at 9/11, haven't we? But there's lots and lots of other issues around that you need to understand a much deeper version of what to really understand what's going on. He really puts it here as putting together various bits of a jigsaw. This is James Perloff again.
And if you just took one piece of it, no piece of it would supply the evidence. But, you know, you look at the League of Nations, and you look at the fact that because of the U.S. Senate's rejection of the League of Nations in 1919, they wouldn't ratify the Versailles Treaty that created the League. Then you see the Council on Foreign Relations created as a direct result of that. They were incorporated in 1921, and this Council on Foreign Relations, which is a subject of my earlier book, The Shadows of Power, has dominated the presidential cabinets, whether the guy in the Oval Office is a Republican or a Democrat. And then you look at the UN being created by these same guys, and these same guys create the World Bank and the IMF. And I know that officially those were instituted at the Bretton Woods Conference, but the Council on Foreign Relations was fomenting those even before then. Then you look at these regional bodies like the EU and NAFTA, and you just see all these globalist measures taking place collectively, and even a drive for one world religion. So it's really, I don't think there's any one piece of evidence in there. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, and if you just talk about 9/11 to people, they say, well, our own government wouldn't do that to us, and if they did, they tell us about it on TV. So you have to give people the whole picture, and that's what I try to do as concisely as possible in this book. So the first chapter is about, it's not just 9/11, it's the sinking of the Maine, it's the Lusitania, it's the foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, it's the artificially created Korean War, it's Tonkin Gulf, it's a no WMDs in Iraq. They've been going on for a long time, and then I say, well, why do you have this pattern? And so we talk about the fact that the same guys are running the government. I talk about the Council on Foreign Relations in Chapter 2, it's about the Fed and how it's wrecked our economy. And I just to run them down, then I talk about the ways that run America, and then I talk about the Vietnam War because it was such an important event, and then I talk about the plan today with the NAFTA, as we've already touched on. Then I talk about media control, and I've got a chapter on the ways they've destroyed national sovereignty. I talk about their international control structures like the Bilderbergers and Trilateral Commission. There's a chapter on environmentalism, which is a tool for control, excuse for control. There's a chapter on Zionism and a whole chapter on 9/11, and don't you need at least a chapter on that? And then chapters on the control of the arts, and a chapter on the war on faith, and a chapter on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and a control on cyber tyranny and on vaccines, on weather control. So I try to give people the whole picture so that they're not getting just one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, because one piece of a jigsaw puzzle, it looks like just a piece of color with no meaning. But if you take a piece of a jigsaw puzzle and you snap it into the entire puzzle, now you see what the big picture is, and now that piece makes sense to you. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book.
So that's James Perloff there speaking about his book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. Well, one, you know, all sorts of interesting stuff in there, but one thing jumps out to me, Martin. I wonder if it's the same to you when he starts talking about the protocols of Zion, because this was used actually by Adolf Hitler, wasn't it, to as part of his campaign against the Jews.
It is, and of course, he may be right about lots of what he's saying, but when you start talking about the protocols of the elders of Zion, you're talking about people basically predicting the future as a prophecy. And of course, the mainstream historical analysis of the protocols of the elders of Zion is that it was actually a document created by the Okhrana, which was the Tsarist secret police, as a mechanism for persecuting the Jewish community inside Russia at that time and making them appear to be problematic.
Can I just say, Martin, that, I mean, my view of this is that it is a completely fictional document. To me, it doesn't read like a real document. Not only that, you know, most of the historical and analysis that's been done over the years would back that up. I mean, it doesn't even look like it, to me, like a very good forgery.
No, but it was basically created as part of a psychological warfare operation by the Tsarist secret police. And then it was picked up and run with. I do not believe in prophecy. I wouldn't try and predict who would win a match between Liverpool and Chelsea, never mind what's going to happen in 100 years' time. But I do know that the Council of Foreign Relations is run by oligarchs and that they're trying to control the world's resources for the benefit of a corrupt.
I mean, the point here is that, I mean, you know, I think, you know, maybe I'm just looking at James Perloff for the first time really and thinking, well, he seems to have got much useful information here, but there's a few little poison pills in there too. But then that is our job as journalists, and it's our job as readers of books, is to make our own decisions, to decide for ourselves what we're going to take and what we're not going to take. And really, it's not, I don't think, YouTube's job to try and do that for us, to say, well, you know, well, this person has mentioned this and therefore they've got to go. I mean, it's, you know, that's at least my opinion of it. But anyway, I thought we'd go and have a listen, because he's talking there about the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group, which are two very powerful Rockefeller Foundation-funded organisations that have grown up over the years. Obviously, other people involved in funding Bilderberg and founding it, like the CIA, but Council on Foreign Relations certainly played an enormous part. The War and Peace Studies Group in the 1943 in the US was already planning Bilderberg 12 years before it ever first had its first meeting. But let's have a listen now to Neil Ferguson. He's the biographer of the Rothschilds. He's also quite well known. Marty, do you want to say something a little bit about Neil Ferguson? Because he's a...
Niall Ferguson.
Niall Ferguson, yeah.
Well, he's a rather right-wing historian. I've read several of his books, and they're quite interesting.
Well, have you read a book of his, the latest one, called The Square and the Tower, Networks?
I did try to read it, but I found myself so annoyed with its pro-establishment bias that I decided I wasn't going to read all
anyway,
of it.
Anyway, we're going to have a little extract from Neil Ferguson now, speaking on C-SPAN about this book, The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from Freemasons to Facebook.
Are you involved with the Schwarzman College?
Yes.
And the reason I bring it up, because I looked up the advisory committee of the Schwarzman College, and it just seemed to me to be one of the great networks
absolutely
you could possibly put together. And I'm going to read down the list.
Yes.
Sarkozy, Tony Blair, Brian Mulroney, Kevin Rudd from Australia, Henry Kissinger, Colin Powell, Hank Paulson, Jim Wolfenson, Bob Rubin, Condi Rice, Rick Levin, who used to be the president of Yale, Richard Haass, the Council on Foreign Relations, Yo-Yo Ma, and others. If I were an outsider looking in, I'd say that's the Illuminati. It's Council on Foreign Relations. It's and what does that mean?
Yeah, well, it means that Steve Schwarzman, who's the brains and the money behind the Schwarzman College, has the Rolodex of Rolodexes, and Steve was able to bring this group together, as well as lesser fry like me, to do the teaching. There are two points that I think one can make. The first is that clearly there is an enormously important network, and you've just listed some of the key nodes in that network. You could find similar names, similar combinations of names, if you went to the World Economic Forum or the Council on Foreign Relations, or you just hung out in New York and the Four Seasons. This is a real elite network, and it is it's very important to recognize that it exists and is not dreamt up by conspiracy theorists. It's not an invention. These mostly men know one another. Second point, this is an elite that seems, in this case, to be trying its best to do something that I think is good, namely to build a new kind of network that connects China to the West. The Schwarzman Scholarship Program was dreamt up by Steve as a kind of version of the Rhodes Scholarships, which used to bring people to Oxford, still bring people to study in Oxford. And the Steve Schwarzman vision was, well, we need to do something similar so that there is more understanding between the future leaders of China and the future leaders of Western countries. I think that's a very good idea. I think the program is a terrific innovation, and I see when I go there terrific students from all around the world, not just Americans, it's from all around the world, getting to understand China better and studying alongside Chinese students at what is the equivalent of MIT or Harvard in China.
Have you been to the Bilderberg meetings?
Yes.
Have you been a member of the Trilateral Commission?
No.
Barney Miller, the television show. This is a 42-second clip, 1981, when this happened, and this is just a television show. Let's run.
All right, what is the Trilateral Commission? It's an organization founded in 1973 by David Rockefeller to bring together business and political leaders from the United States, Europe, Japan, so they could work together for better economic and political cooperation between their nations.
Well, that's what they'd like us to believe. But you see, what they're really up to is a scheme to plant their own loyal members in positions of power in this country, to work to erase national boundaries and create an international community, and in time, bring about a one-world government with David Rockefeller calling the shots.
Sir, what do you think?
Well, there you have the conspiracy theory that we were talking about earlier, that they say they're meeting in order to improve the world and improve economic policy coordination, but actually they're hatching a plan to erase national boundaries and establish world government under David Rockefeller. So the stated objectives are the objectives, and the notion that there is going to be a world government at the end of it is the fantasy. Now, I can't speak for the Trilateral Commission, I'm not involved with that, but I can assure you that although the meetings of the Bilderberg group are closed, nobody ever mentioned world government to me at those meetings. On the contrary, I'm always struck by the extent to which at such gatherings the discussion is reactive. You know, here's another fine mess the world is in. Is there anything we can do about it? You don't have a strong sense of there being control. Even the word power seems strangely inappropriate. This network is commenting on the world, exchanging ideas. I'm sure there's an element of business involved too. But we shouldn't exaggerate the power of even the most exclusive networks. What's striking to me when I interact with these groups is not their power, but often their sense of powerlessness. If you think about the events of 2016, just to take an example, not many members of the supposed world government planned that Britain would vote to leave the European Union and that Donald Trump would become president of the United States. Donald Trump is definitely not somebody who gets invited to those meetings. So then, or for example, take the financial crisis, the events of 2008-9. Nobody sat there at the Bilderberg meeting in 2008 saying, I think what we really need for the world government is a massive financial crisis. No, what's striking when you spend time in these rarefied circles is the lack of power. Influence, yes. These people, the people who are involved with the Schwarzman College, very influential people. But I think that power tends to be exaggerated, and if there is a world government being put together, it's not doing very well. It's not going very well. But I don't think that's ever been the project. It's interesting, actually, to mention David Rockefeller. I read the other day that Rockefeller, whose network predated the age of the internet and existed on a giant Rolodex, was one of the biggest networks of probably of all time, in the sense that with the limits of technology, there's only so many people that you can keep a tab on. And 100,000 names, I seem to remember, were in this giant system of index cards, including some of the names that you read. Certainly Henry Kissinger was in that list. I'm in the midst of writing Kissinger's biography, and for me, part of the way to understand Kissinger's rise from being an academic and a public intellectual to being an extraordinarily influential Secretary of State is to understand that network, and to understand the ways in which it worked, so that his influence extended beyond government, extended across borders, was in many ways global. To me, this is historically very interesting. But one has to talk about it and write about it without exaggerating the power of the network. The influence, yes, but I think the power was more circumscribed, much as was true in the case of the Rothschild Bank, which I wrote about back in the 1990s. Yes, the Rothschilds were probably the richest people in the world in the 19th century, and their banks were tremendously influential in the way that the bond market evolved, and therefore in the way that governments could borrow. But at the time, conspiracy theorists said that they had total power over the world, that they determined whether there was war or whether there was peace, that they controlled the central banks, etc. Well, I showed in my book, The World's Banker, that was mostly untrue, that the Rothschilds couldn't determine war and peace, and very often would be frustrated and would suffer losses when wars broke out. So I think the challenge for the historian who wants to write about networks is striking that balance between delineating the influence, trying to measure it and calibrate it, and also identifying the limits of the network's power.
Martin, the idea of influence and power being two different things, he's saying there effectively that the Bilderberg and people like this are really just talking shops, that they don't actually have any real power.
Well, I mean, the more extreme conspiracy theorists, which see one overarching conspiracy running everything, I think Niall Ferguson is probably right to say that's wrong. But on the other hand, he's an establishment figure. And basically, by writing the kind of books he writes, he is basically tackling the sort of topics we tackle, but from an establishment perspective. So he's giving the kind of, this isn't really dangerous. They have influence, but they don't have power. I don't really know what the difference between influence and power is. I mean, is there a difference? If I can influence you to do something, that's a power, isn't it? I think the Ferguson is an intelligent, but very flawed individual. He's, for example, one of the things he did is he wrote a book about the British Empire where he basically said the US have taken over from the British Empire and it's a good thing, and that the US Empire is a good thing. If you remember, we went to see him speak in Temple Meads
some years ago. Yeah.
In the M shed, yeah. And he was basically saying that, He was basically covering up for the CIA and others and their bad behaviour. He's a very establishment figure, and his books are well written and he's well researched. But basically, he covers the kind of territory we cover, but from the point of view of establishment.
Okay,
that's what I'd say about him.
He's talking about a world government maybe coming out through just without actually this being a deliberate conspiracy to make it happen. It's going to kind of happen anyway.
Well, if you think about it, there is constant negotiation going on between the powerful people in the world. I mean, the Chinese and the US have diplomatic relations with each other, although that may end sometime soon.
But Kissinger has said, hasn't he, and we covered this a few weeks ago, Henry Kissinger, on this pandemic crisis, he's saying, well, look, you know, you're going to have a world government, otherwise the world is going to catch fire. So he's saying basically, I mean, the thing is with Kissinger, of course, you're never quite sure whether he's giving you a genuine warning or whether there's a bit of menace, a bit of threat in that.
Well, ultimately, what's going on is that the oligarchy in the West, with their Israeli allies, are trying to take over the world. And there's various other forces at work which are trying to stop them. And ultimately, this will lead to World War III, probably, and there will be a decision. Ultimately, if we get through this next phase of human history, there will be some kind of world coordination. I mean, it's pretty obvious that we're going to have one. The question is, who's going to run it? Is it going to be run by the ordinary people, or is it going to be run by these rapacious oligarchs?
It's funny you're saying that, because who's going to run it? The World Health Organization. But the thing is, a lot of these international organizations...
The World Health Organization has just been defunded by the US.
Well, a lot of these international organizations, though, are actually controlled by one faction or another faction. There's very few that aren't nowadays.
That's right. The UN, basically, is based in New York. So, for example, the Iranian foreign minister was forbidden to come to speak at it.
And the Venezuelans. Yeah.
Well, exactly. So, in other words, it isn't a one-government world. What you've got is the rapacious oligarchs which run the Western powers, and they've been running it for hundreds of years, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, all the rest of them. They want to run the world, and they don't want a communist Chinese upstart to take any of their power. And they don't want an independent Britain which didn't have nuclear weapons and wasn't in NATO. So if Corbyn came to be prime minister, you could be sure that they'd be working to undermine him, even if he'd managed to get there. And we know what we're up against.
Okay,
and,
but
they're playing for world domination.
These guys would argue with you, Martin. They say, well, we own the world, and when we should control it.
Well, that's what they say. Is they've got people like Niall Ferguson, who are very well paid, to come out and say, there's nothing to see here, folks. It's just, we're all just doing our best to try and
anyway, one of the major struggles, of course, is the free press, which we're hoping to be carrying on being part of. A little corner of freedom here in an old Templar port, the Port of Bristol, close by to, the Bristol Temple Meads and all that. But we're trying to do our best. One of the things that really annoys me is when someone interesting like James Perloff gets censored from YouTube. So let's hear now again from him from the same video, the censored one, COVID-1984, it's called. Where are we heading? This is James Perloff's take.
The whole idea of a digital ID, quoting Bill Gates, he said, quote, eventually we'll have some digital certificates to show who has recovered or been tested recently, or when we have a vaccine, who has received it. So it's very easy to see where this is going down the pike, Sean, that eventually, say the next flu season, they'll say that the after they get us sort of back on board with the economy, they'll say, COVID-19 has come back. COVID-19 has come back. We have to be in lockdown. And what are Americans going to say? Oh, no. We can't have another lockdown. We can't afford another lockdown. So what's going to happen is, or what they'd like to have happen is that Bill Gates will say, well, no problem. We've got a vaccine ready now. All you've got to do, if you want to work and travel and go to the grocery to shop, all you got to do is get your vaccine, and then we'll implant a RFID chip onto your skin. Wherever you go, you just want to get that thing get wanded, and it'll verify that you've had your vaccine. Of course, that would also enable the government to track your whereabouts for the rest of your life, especially once we're into the 5G grid. So, you know, Sean, this is just amazing to me. You know, if we go to the Bible and we go to the book of Revelation, chapter 13, it says, and the second beast required all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark. Now, Bill Gates, who's part of this whole digital, ID 2020, which has their own website, where they've got the Rockefeller Foundation and the Microsoft images right next to each other as part as among their partners, right? They want a global ID along with a global vaccine for the entire planet and a cashless society, as you were saying, that they're stopping taking cash because it might have this gremlin-like COVID-19 cootie on it if you take a dollar bill. So what they're talking about is right out of what's predicted in the Bible. It's pretty frightening to see it, the things that we've been talking about for years, to actually be coming true.
So this is one of James Perloff's things, Martin. It'd be interesting to hear what your take is. Are you someone that doesn't believe in prophecy? He's saying some of this stuff, it could have been prophesied in the Bible.
Well, as I say, I wouldn't try and prophesy who's going to win the 330 at Newmarket. So I don't accept that. I think there's a lot of people think that. That's for sure. That's definitely the case. And of course, it may well be that people like Gates and Kissinger and the others, they're influenced by the Book of Revelation. So they may be consciously or unconsciously fulfilling the prophecy.
But certainly, I mean, their attitude surely is that this is a useful thing, that if we can spin it so that it looks like, you know, where the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys, that they see this as an opportunity to actually feed on this and turn it to their own advantage.
All right, well, let's put it this way. If they come up with a vaccine, I'm going to be very, very suspicious. It may well be the case, as after the anthrax attacks after 9/11, which definitely came from Fort Detrick, but loads of people at the top in the US, including Bush, have been given Cyprian, I think it's called, which is a pill which counteracts anthrax. So there's definitely foreknowledge there. Okay? Now, it may well be that they're going to try and use this, to, as suggested, to make a compulsory vaccine. I sent you stuff from the Nigerian press, which I think should definitely be on the show page so people can check what's going on in Nigeria. They're definitely trying to push this. But we'll come back to what we said earlier, and various people have said this. I can't remember who exactly said it on this show. It's quite possible that there is no vaccine for COVID. It's a cold virus. We haven't got vaccines for colds. So if that's the case, then there's no way that they can push a vaccine compulsorily on everybody because there ain't a vaccine. And that's what the opposition in Nigeria have been saying. Why are you saying we're going to have compulsory vaccination? You haven't even got a vaccine. What are you talking about?
So we'll leave the last word to James Perloff, who is convinced that there's some biblical perspective on all of this. And I find it quite shocking that YouTube can censor this sort of thing. I mean, surely Christian attitude and interpretation should be allowed to be seen. So we leave you with James Perloff. Is world government actually a good idea from a biblical perspective?
2 Thessalonians 2:3-4 says, quote, "Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day," meaning the end of days, "will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction, who will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God," unquote, for the Bible. And, you know, there's this plan in Israel, of course, to rebuild the temple. That is not, we're not supposed to do that. Jesus pronounced a curse on the temple. This whole idea is satanic. But there's definitely this plan of Satan to set himself or some sort of proxy up in Jerusalem over greater Israel, which would be the capital of this world government, and to oppress mankind for what the Bible predicts will be a period of 3.5 years. So it is both human in that you have these banksters who are promised, you know, mansions and power in return for their favors. But you, at the top of the very, very top, you do have a Luciferian agenda, as I said, Bohemian Grove and Satan worship that various intelligence analysts have talked about these people doing shows that it is Luciferian. And again, that affirms what we were talking about earlier, how this is not a beneficial but an evil agenda that is the end game of this world government.
So that's James Perloff there winding up this program, and I'll put some links onto the censored YouTube video. Someone else has popped it up somewhere else, and so you can have a look at that if you like. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCAFM weekend. You can listen on Sunday evenings at 7 to Danny Lopsch. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be here on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but it hasn't appeared so far. Listen out again at 10 on Monday. We'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart winning. Do please join us for the politics show late afternoon next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
white from the Caucasian Times. Are you a drug dealer? And if so, why?
Gerald Hawksworth, White Man's Gazette. Why are our prisons so overpopulated with black men?
Excuse me, wait here.
Peter Clanning, the White Street Journal. Why is it that most violent crimes are committed by black American males?
I'm just a young black man trying to be paid so I could be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. The welfare don't pay enough. A good job for the young black man is a buffer. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. I only rob the rich to feed my family, and now they call me a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. 'Cause I'm a menace to society. Guess I'm a menace to society. Good job in a place like Steel Mill sounds good, but I make more money from my neighborhood, and my neighborhood keeps both pockets fat, so I keep going back. That's where the money's at. Black from hell, that's who I am and where I've been. Task force rolls by, I grin. Then I commence to collecting my mail, hoping and praying not to end up in a jail cell. Mama's whole life is dependent on me, 'cause it's hard to survive on AFDC. Food stamps, free milk and cheese. When I think about it, hit another liquor store and yell freeze. Everybody on the floor. Then I empty the cash drawer and run for the front door. This is the reason why, you see, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm called a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Furthermore, I feel the needs of the black community has yet to be met. Our federal government and its corporate allies have the means necessary to put an end to this political oppression, which continues to keep the African American struggling for survival.
The streets are unsafe. With a brother like me, see, I take your car, VCR, and your TV. I drive away singing songs on your radio. My conscience starts talking to me, saying way to go. 'Cause once again, my family could be fed, the rent is paid. So we can rest ahead. I look forward to a brighter day. All I could do is pray and hope and pray. Task force is brutal, and I'm angry. The DA sees a brother like me and wants to hang me. Run across a brother like me and can't hack and jack a young punk quick. For a Raiders jacket, I run the streets just to get my grit on, so my family can have some decent furniture to sit on. So don't try to tell me how to be, 'cause I'ma just be me. Sign menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. Yes, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Grave, result of a drive-by. I hate it 'cause I know it makes my mother cry. Her whole life is a nervous wreck, and I'm a social reject trying to get a paycheck. Society is giving birth to a fool like me. I'm a T-H-R-E-A-T, so they label me lazy. They say I'm uneducated, violent, and crazy. But I'm a young black man trying to be paid so I can be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't quite pay enough. A job for the young black man is a cover. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. They say I'm a menace to society, but society's a menace to me. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. They say I'm a menace to society. Society's a menace to me. Yeah.